How much do we think we know about the First Amendment? How many of us have looked at and considered the full texts? More than likely, we rely not on our own reading of the document and its various clauses, but on our Supreme Court's interpretations and rulings to flesh out its true intent. But what if the Supreme Court got it wrong? In the new book, Madison's Music on Reading the First Amendment, Bert Newborn, a former legal director of the ACLU who has argued many cases before the Supreme Court, contends that they have gotten it wrong, that by failing to relate to the text as a coherent whole, the court has incrementally and collectively warped the original intent of the First Amendment. Again, the title of the book is Madison's Music. It is published by the New Press, and we welcome Bert Newborn to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What got you thinking about the reading of the First Amendment and to, as I said in the introduction, taking it as that whole?
Well, I mean, it isn't just ordinary folks that are at fault. It's lawyers and judges as well. I don't think you could find a person on the bench right now who's read the entire text of the First Amendment recently. What we wind up doing is we wind up talking about the First Amendment as though it's a thing. And then we immediately move to the question of a robust free speech principle and then talk about what the robust free speech principle should look like. But we don't look at the text at all, which is really quite extraordinary in today where text really matters. And so the thesis of my book is that if we only looked at the text, we would find an extraordinary, coherent, and careful structure that tells a real story, and that the story that the text tells, if only you would read it and recognize how the ideas are put together, help you then decide what the First Amendment should mean. And so I say that that's why I call it Madison's Music. What he did when he orchestrated the Bill of Rights was to very carefully order the structure of the six clauses in the First Amendment and the 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights. And if only we will recapture that remarkable structure, which, by the way, is unique in our cultural heritage. No document ranging all the way back from the Magna Carta or all the way forward to the French Declaration of the Rights of Man did anything like the amazing organizational job that Madison did in the Bill of Rights.
And you liken it to a poem, and in fact, not just the First Amendment, but the entire Bill of Rights.
The entire Bill of Rights. That's right. I mean, nobody would think of reading a poem just by pulling a couple of lines out or a couple of words out, holding the words and then saying, I understand the poem because I'm reading six words. But when the Supreme Court approaches the First Amendment, what they wind up doing, to the extent they use text at all, they take the free speech clause, which is the third clause that says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. They tear that out of 45 words. They hold that in their hand. They take the words the freedom of and throw it away, because that requires a little too much thinking to decide what's inside the freedom of speech and outside the freedom of speech. And they then read it as a truncated text that says Congress shall make no law abridging speech. Now, that's a powerful norm, and it's a norm that I support very often. Don't forget, I was legal director of the ACLU for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good thing to have a powerful First Amendment. But if you just say that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging speech, it's rootless. You're not linked to anything. You know it can't be literally true. You're going to abridge blackmail. You're going to abridge extortion. You're not going to allow people to make threats. So that we know that there are some things that are outside the freedom of speech. And so my challenge is to stop just looking at those seven words and pretending that that answers every question about what the First Amendment means. Look at the whole First Amendment. Ask why the speech clause is third. Why the amendment starts with establishment and then of religion and then moves to free exercise of religion. If you look at the First Amendment, there are six clauses in it. The establishment clause, the free exercise of religion clause, the free speech clause, the free press clause, the free assembly clause, and the freedom to petition clause. And if you think about why they are ordered that way, the first two protect freedom of thought, So that's where your the ideas in a democracy will generate, inside the free conscience and free mind of a protected citizen. Then you move to speech, which is the next clause. Once you have an idea, you're allowed to articulate it. Then once you have an idea that you want to articulate, then you want to have mass dissemination. That's the role of the press clause. That's why it comes right after the speech clause. Once you have mass dissemination, then you want to have collective action. That's the assembly clause, right after the press clause. Once you have collective action, then you want to present it to the legislature for either adoption or rejection through the formal vote of a democratic legislature. It couldn't be any other way. If you were setting up the blueprint for a democracy, you couldn't structure those six clauses any other way. And yet, what the Supreme Court does today is to read only the third clause, only the free speech clause. I call it the imperial free speech clause, which has conquered the rest of the amendment. The press clause has no independent meaning. The assembly clause has been gutted. Look at what they did to Occupy Wall Street. The petition clause has no current meaning. And the First Amendment free speech clause is even affecting the way they're talking about religious freedom. So my challenge is, why did they put 45 words in there if you're only going to use seven? And if we're serious about text, then we've got to go back and read the entire First Amendment, see the story it tells us, and interpret the amendment through those eyes.
So it's fascinating in what you just spoke about of the way the court so often abridges those words from 45 to 7. Let us talk about Madison's abridgment. He had some 42 existing rights-conferring documents to draw on, you note in the book. And this is going back to the Magna Carta. So he, as he considered the amendments to our Constitution, he had these documents to draw from. So with what you just said in taking us through the building of it, what is important to know about his selection and ordering of rights?
So that's a great question. I mean, you're right. He had 42 documents, and he had a rule of thumb. His rule of thumb was that he wasn't going to put anything in the Bill of Rights that didn't appear in those earlier documents in a way that had been tested and worked and people had some idea what they meant. So the source documents was the Magna Carta, the several English Bills of Rights, the various colonial charters, and the various revolutionary state constitutions, plus a lot of advice from the ratifying conventions that ratified the Constitution. And he wouldn't put anything in there unless it appeared three times, so it was a time-tested device. And then his initial instinct was not to have a separate Bill of Rights, but to interpolate the various rights into the body of the Constitution right next to the power that they were designed to check. And Roger Sherman persuaded the Congress, instead of doing that, where they would have gotten lost, to pull them all out and list them in this remarkably coherent way. And the thesis of my book is that if you just look at the order, the six ideas in the First Amendment, and then look vertically at the 10 amendments, with the First Amendment being the city on the hill that he wanted to create, and then looking at the 10 amendments as essentially amendments 2 through 8, is a listing of all of the risks to the city on the hill, all of the dangers listed by order of magnitude. So the first two, the second and third, deal with military overthrow and military subversion, because Madison knew that the fate of most democracies is to be overthrown by the military. And that's been borne out, sadly, in the history of democratic governance in the world. The fate of most democracies is military overthrow. So Madison put up, that's why the Second Amendment is right after the First. It's right after the First because that was what he saw as the greatest danger. And his institutional fix was to create a shadow army of the people called the well-regulated militia, all of whom had guns and all of whom could react if the standing army, if the non-representative military army tried to overthrow the government, then the shadow army of the people could respond and defend democracy. So that in the 21st century, now that we don't have a well-regulated militia anymore, the real story of the Second Amendment is to say that the organs of armed coercion, whether it's the militia in 18th century Virginia or the police force in 21st century Ferguson, Missouri, that the organs of armed coercion must look like the people they serve. if they don't, if they're not representative of the people they serve, they will turn on the people. They will become a danger to the people, especially the excluded segments. And the great wisdom of the Second Amendment is that it should be read as a guarantee that we are all entitled to serve in the organs of armed coercion. The gays, blacks, women, that there's no segment of American society that can be denied the right to bear arms in defense of democracy. And the great tragedy is that the current Supreme Court, instead of understanding that the Second Amendment is second because it was designed to protect the first, just pulled it out of the text, ignored the history of the well-regulated militia, and reads it as a kind of deracinated right to own a .22 rifle or a pistol without any connection to the protection of democracy.
I find it fascinating. I mean, a distillation of what you're saying in this book is you talk about the court's interpretation of the freedom of assembly, basically as an extension of the free speech clause, which then you say begs the question of why then did Madison pen a separate freedom of assembly clause?
Exactly. And you could even do it more vigorously with freedom of the press clause. I'm reaching more people now talking to you than I could in my whole lifetime. I could, if I spoke and spoke and spoke just to people around me, I'm reaching more people speaking to you now than I could reach just with the force of my own voice. And so Madison understood that in a democracy, you need some organ that will provide for mass dissemination of the thought, and that's the press. And the Supreme Court has essentially read the press clause out of the First Amendment. They say that the free speech clause does all the heavy lifting and all the press clause is decorative. They've done that with the assembly clause. They've done that with the petition clause. And my challenge, my question is, well, then why did Madison waste the ink in writing those clauses if the First Amendment does all the work? And the answer is, it's because the court doesn't read the whole text and they don't see the connection of the clauses to each other. If they saw the connection of the clauses to each other, they would recognize, first, that the campaign finance cases are flatly wrong, that you cannot say that the First Amendment essentially guarantees the right of the rich to dominate the democratic process. What kind of a democracy is that? I mean, that's not what Madison was attempting to create. And the six ideas that tell the story of the half-life of a democratic idea are not intended to create a system where the rich have infinitely more political power than anybody else. But it also would require you to say what a free press clause looks like in a democracy. A free press clause would have the ability to investigate. You couldn't keep them out of prisons to find out what's going on inside of prisons. You couldn't create this enormous layer and layer of secrecy in Washington that makes it impossible for anybody to ever find out what's happening. The press would have special investigatory powers, but they would also have a responsibility to see to it that weak voices were allowed to speak as well. And the assembly clause. I mean, what happened to Occupy Wall Street is a disgrace. They simply closed it down because it became inconvenient, because it became a little too inconvenient to have people in public spaces. But the assembly clause is a crucial part of the First Amendment. It is, in fact, the only place where speech is really free. It's free because it's the only place where poor people can speak by using body rhetoric and by using sweat equity and by getting their ideas across. They don't have to own a newspaper. They don't have to have gone to Princeton to be able to write a book. They can have their needs understood through assembly, through body rhetoric. And for the court not to recognize that that's the moral core of the First Amendment is one of the sad results of not recognizing that those six clauses tell us a magnificent story if we will only listen to them.
You suggest that the First Amendment as we know it today did not exist before Justice William Brennan and the rest of the Warren Court invented it, as you say, in the 1960s. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, there are two issues there. I mean, the issue is first, is the text as clear as I say it is? Because, you know, it starts with Congress shall make no law. So we don't read the text literally. Nobody wants it to just be covered by Congress. Everybody wants it to be government. So there's a sort of embarrassment about reading it literally. But there's also an embarrassment about reading it historically. If you try to read it historically, the ink was not dry on the First Amendment. before John Adams locked up most of the newspaper editors who were opposing him in the election of 1800, including Vermont's member of Congress, Matthew Lyons. They were locked up for opposing Adams. So if you go back to the beginning, the vision of the First Amendment at the beginning was not a strong one. It was feeble. If you look at free speech during the 19th century, labor organizers, economic radicals, abolitionists, they were all suppressed throughout the 19th century, and the First Amendment didn't do much about it. If you look at the First World War, opponents to the First World War were jailed in droves, and the First Amendment didn't do much about it. If you look at the growth of the labor movement during the 30s and early 40s, the First Amendment was a feeble protection. And then when you look what happened to the Communist Party under McCarthy, where they actually sent the leadership of the Communist Party to jail, not because they had done anything illegal, but just for being the head of the Communist Party. And the First Amendment couldn't protect them. So it wasn't until we came out of the McCarthy era, came out of the 50s, and into the 1960s, into the civil rights movement and into the opposition to the war in Vietnam, that the First Amendment was seized by the court and used as a mechanism to protect those new voices. And that's why I say the modern doctrine of the First Amendment emerges in the 1960s, and it doesn't get solidified until 1969.
I've talked to and interviewed many Supreme Court experts over the years, and there seems to be a consensus that Citizens United is a decision that is one of the most shocking that ever came in the court, certainly in the past century. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think it's an appalling decision. But if we got rid of Citizens United tomorrow, we wouldn't fix the problem. The problem really goes back to 1976, to a case called Buckley versus Valeo, where the court held that spending money in connection with an election campaign is exactly the same thing as speaking. So once you link money and speech, you inevitably weight the system in favor of the rich. Now, Citizens United made it much worse, because what they not only now is have individual wealthy people pouring money into it, but now we've opened up the corporate coffers, and that's almost an unlimited amount of money that can be poured into the system in order to advance the essentially business interests and large business interests of the country. So, yes, Citizens United is terrible. I mean, the idea that a corporation has the dignity that really is what the First Amendment is all about. The First Amendment is about protecting human dignity, and the fact that a corporation now has the kind of dignity that will be protected by the free speech is a kind of legal fiction run amok. You know, we created corporations to serve us, to be able to be efficient mechanisms for the collection and use of investment funds. And by and large, they've been hugely successful. I mean, it's been a very, very successful way of organizing assets in a society. But over time, what's happening is that we've created a Frankenstein. The corporation, which was designed to protect us, now all of a sudden is emerging as our friend. The corporation puts its arm around you and says, "Hey, guess what? I have free speech rights. I'm now just as dignified as you are." And all of a sudden, the corporation runs us. We don't run the corporation. And it's the same thing with Hobby Lobby. The corporations now not only have the dignity to speak, but they have the dignity to pray. And one of the brief I wrote in Hobby Lobby said, "Hey, I know that corporations pray, but they P-R-E-Y. I didn't know that they P-R-A-Y." And it's inconceivable that a corporation will have a religious conscience. So I don't understand how Hobby Lobby fits into the First Amendment, and I don't understand how Citizens United fits into the First Amendment.
Well, the book is endlessly fascinating. It is Madison's Music on Reading the First Amendment. It is published by the New Press. Bert Newborn, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise and your knowledge with our audience this morning.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Madison's Music on Reading the First Amendment. It is published by the New Press. Bert Newborn is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.